Welcome to Media Shift number 183, your guide to the digital media revolution. I'm Mark Glazer. We switched up the format of the podcast once again, away from roundtable discussion, with more thoughts from yours truly. We'll also have a roundup of the top news and a chat with one special guest. We've changed up our format a few times over the years, starting with the four-minute roundup, which was just a quick look at the week's news, then switching to the media twits, with me and Rafat Ali as co-hosts talking to one guest, then becoming a roundtable discussion with regulars like Anna Marie Cox, Felix Salmon, Monica Guzman, Andrew Lee. And now we're kind of back full circle with more of a discussion, a little bit more from me. On this week's show, I'll run down the news of the week, including Strange Bedfellows, Univision, and The Onion. I'll talk about MediaShift's 10-year anniversary this week and what it takes to survive as an independent online media company. And wouldn't you know, our guest this week is Rafat Ali, media blogging pioneer who started paid content and now runs travel service site Skift. MediaShift, in association with Acquia, is producing a free online panel, How to Personalize Your Content for Better Engagement, with top online publishers describing their winning strategies. I'll be moderating the session on Big Marker. It will happen on March 2nd at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. We hope you'll join us. Register at bit.ly/pcontent to save your spot. Now for the big news of the week. First up, Univision takes a 40% stake in The Onion, valuing it at $500 million. It's actually twice as much as the Washington Post sold for to Jeff Bezos. Is this funny ha-ha news, or funny as in weird? Or maybe both? It's really strange bedfellows if you think about a Spanish language broadcast network getting deeper into digital as The Onion had dumped print in 2013. The Onion has been a satirical voice online for some time, starting as a weekly newspaper in the past. Univision was aiming to take over its joint venture Infusion, so it's also being very ambitious online. It has a 40% stake in The Onion and also has a chance to buy the entire operation out. The most interesting part about the story is the way that so many publications had fun with headlines about The Onion, because can you really take it seriously when something serious happens to The Onion? NPR's headline was, "Area satirical publication The Onion sold to Univision. Seriously." Or the Miami Herald, "Univision bites into The Onion." Number two story we're looking at is Al Jazeera America closes down. It was plagued by cultural issues and the stigma of being an Arab media company trying to invade the U.S., so to speak, didn't really fly. They're also sued over management bias. It was really difficult for Al Jazeera, which had made such a big mark in the Arab world, to come to the U.S. and to build a U.S. audience. And really, the biggest problem is audience numbers. I mean, according to Nielsen, they only had 28,000 viewers in primetime on TV. On the more positive side, AJ Plus, the mobile app, will continue despite the closing of Al Jazeera America. The third story we're looking at is Tech's Frightful Five Will Dominate Digital Life by Farhad Manju at the New York Times. Really a look at very large and getting larger tech companies, but also in the media space, and just how much they're dominating Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, and also Microsoft with its comeback. And why are they dominating? Because they built platforms, according to Manju. Here's a quote from his story. "The Big Five's platforms span so-called old tech. Windows is still the king of desktops, and Google rules web search. And new tech, with Google and Apple controlling mobile phone operating systems and apps that run on them. And Facebook and Google controlling internet ad business. And Amazon, Microsoft, and Google controlling the cloud infrastructure that many startups run on. And Amazon has a shopping and shipping infrastructure." End quote. When it comes down to it, we all have kind of a love-hate relationship with these really large tech conglomerates. You know, they've let us down in so many ways as they get larger But it's hard to stop our habits. We might be mad at Amazon. In the past, they didn't really treat their warehouse workers very well. They've led to the closing of a lot of small independent bookstores, but it's convenient to get stuff by Amazon. It's great, you know, getting Amazon Prime, getting access to music and TV shows. So, you know, we love these big companies, and it's hard to drop them. It's hard to remove them from our life because they're so much insinuated into our life. They're weaved into our life in so many ways. And the last story is Netflix adding more subscribers than expected. In their recent report, they've now hit nearly 75 million customers, and they expect to add 6.1 million more this quarter. The recent CES show in Vegas, they announced they had added expansion into 130 countries to reach 190 countries total around the world. It's pretty impressive. Although they are having issues reaching China, probably due to some content issues, censorship. It's not always an easy market to crack. But Netflix really is growing bigger and bigger and becoming a force. Maybe they'll become one of the Frightful Five. Maybe they'll be the Frightful Six if they can get big enough. Time will tell. On January 18th, 2006, PBS launched an exciting new blog, Media Shift, dedicated to becoming your guide to the media revolution. Well, this week marks the 10th anniversary of the founding of that blog, which has now become a little independent media concern at mediashift.org. So how do we get here? How do we survive? And what are our prospects? The origin story of Media Shift is that I wanted to do the things I've been writing about. Instead of talking about blogs, podcasts, interactive media, I wanted to do them myself. I wanted to test them out firsthand. With funding from PBS, I was able to get my start with this one-person blog, but that wasn't enough. I wanted it to grow into something bigger than just me and just my voice. So I raised money with a grant from Knight Foundation to start another blog called Idea Lab, which would focus on firsthand accounts from people who received Knight News Challenge grants. It could be looking over the shoulder of innovators as they wrote about their experience. Then I hired more people to help sell sponsorships. I launched email newsletters, started producing mixer events, which led to one-day collab space workshops, then weekend hackathons for journalism students. Now we even produce online trainings called Digital Ed. As we were growing and growing and growing, more people working for me, more revenues coming in, but also more complications, more to juggle, more stress. And as we were more successful, PBS figured it wouldn't have to fund us anymore. It was the success penalty, as I called it. So last summer, we bid adieu to PBS, where they showed us the door, and we were a true independent online media company. We're for profit, but with a public media bent to serve. Our latest grant is from Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to launch a new section, Metric Shift, devoted to media metrics, analytics, and measuring deeper impact. So how do we survive? Obviously, PBS gave us a big leg up, this recognizable brand, and distribution and help with social media, thanks to Kevin Dando, of course. Also, we have a willingness to change, try new things, and reach beyond our comfort zone and to listen to our audience. In a survey a few years back, our audience asked for two big things, trainings and workshops. In a recent survey, they asked for trainings once again. So we're trying to deliver that. But we also had to learn what not to do, what was beyond our expertise. We didn't want to do a massive commercial multi-day conference like ONA. We chose to do more intimate events where connection could happen. And we didn't take on flashy, annoying, gimmick-type ads on our site, do clickbait stories. We don't want to lose sight of our audience as being our most important customer, not the advertisers, not the sponsors. And in the chase for clicks and size and scale, we want to do something else. Have an engaged audience. And engagement is obviously the buzzword du jour, but what does it really mean? Getting people to comment, getting people to click on a couple more stories. We want people to care about digital media, making it better, making it sustainable, making it more than just a chase for clicks, finding meaning. If we can continue to do that for our audience, our community, then Media Shift can survive another 10 years and beyond. But if not, then we shouldn't waste your time. We should just shut down. And of course, we couldn't have made it this far without all the people editing, writing, marketing, selling, producing, and supporting our design and technology over the years. Our team has been really amazing, and I thank them for everything they've done. So here's to many more years to come, sticking to do what we do best, staying focused, and making sure our audience comes along for the ride. It's been a great 10 years so far. As we are in the spirit now of thinking about the 10th anniversary of Media Shift this week, 10 years old, we're also reconnecting with a familiar voice from our Media Twits podcast from previous years, Rafid Ali, a pioneering media blogger who started paid content from scratch. He built it into something much bigger, sold it to The Guardian, which eventually sold it to GigaOM, which eventually smothered it. Then GigaOM went out of business. It's not easy surviving as an independent online publication. In any case, Rafid has been a very avid traveler, and so he really followed his passion, or maybe killed it, by starting a site dedicated to the travel business, Skift. He got seed funding from some of the leading lights in media and aimed to build more than just a media company. It was to offer data and services and a lot more. But recently, Rafid posted an eye-opening essay on the journey of Skift, how they stopped pursuing scale for the sake of scale, the big VC round of funding, decided to stay independent and bootstrap their success. As Rafid said in his essay, "My personal philosophy in all this has always been perseverance above all else. Keep your head down, build stuff, focus on building a business, and good things will happen. This world deals in a lot of buzz, which can be hugely distracting. Your whole existence can get swept up in it. Avoid scenesters, and surely avoid becoming one." Welcome back to the podcast, Rafid.
Thank you. So great to be back after a long time.
So first of all, I know we talked a lot about personal stuff when we were doing the podcast together, but I'm curious, what is it like now balancing, you know, family life with running a small business?
So it's been a fascinating journey for the last year. You know, all the cliches about fatherhood and parenthood in general are true, and true for a reason. I think that as the journey of parenthood has progressed over the last year, it just so happens that Skift as a company has also turned inwards in a lot of ways. It would be too much for me to say one led to the other, but it's a good journey on both sides, both from a business perspective of building the company as well as my personal life. And so, as you saw in that essay that I wrote, Mark, very much about being able to balance the work that we do at Skift and making sure that our employees have a healthy work-life balance. As part of that, that also obviously applies to me. So I am, for the last year, leaving office at an unheard of time of 5 p.m. So I leave office at 5 p.m., which is just mind-boggling.
it definitely is.
And so that has been huge in so many ways. But that also has, you know, led for us to make sure that we work really hard between the hours of, let's say, 8 to 6 in general.
I have a 2-year-old now, and I've joked around that it's like another startup. You know, it's like you're starting a whole, and for you as your first kid, it's like, I mean, it is a startup. It's like you really have to figure out a new way of doing things, and it's around the clock.
Yeah, and with our first kid, we're first-time entrepreneurs, unlike Skift, which is our second time.
That's true. Startup
life. So we're learning. Obviously, you know, I have a co-founder with my wife, so that helps. And well, she's the founder. I'm just a mere co-founder. but that helps a lot. She's done an amazing job with our son. And so, it's been joyful in all possible ways. And it's helped put me in perspective. I mean, I've this half-written essay that I'll put out at some point on patience as a business model. And the idea that now that my son is turning one, I'm thinking about what is the one big thing that I can possibly help him learn that will help him in his life. And that skill is to develop patience in all possible ways. And that's, you know, in an age of instant gratification and all, you know, we know this intimately from being, you know, semi part of the tech industry, that that's what the world is these days and moving towards. In that age, is there a way to teach him patience? And that also patience in terms of building the company. So also those two things converge. So that's, I'm in halfway through the process of thinking how to write that.
It's hard to, how do you preach patience? I mean, everything is about on demand and getting it now and, you know, social media and, you know, you're waiting in line, you've got your smartphone. It doesn't feel like there's any patience left at all.
I know, but my Hail Mary is to send him to India and then he'll learn patience just because India is so frustrating. So if that, you know, if it comes to that, go 10 years in India and you'll learn patience.
What was it like that moment where you decided, you know, you were going to give up the chase for VC money for Skift? What did that feel like for you?
You know, in some ways it was very gratifying, which I wrote about it, but it's also very, you know, among the lowest professional moments in my life, certainly because, you know, I'm a very known entity in the venture world. For me to not be able to raise money for my company with a track record that at least has one success in it, was certainly very humbling. So it was definitely a low point in my life, but the choices had been eliminated, which is we only had one choice. So that helped, you know, in a lot of ways, focus and, you know, end up being where we are today. That's a lot of what the essay was about. You know, it would have been worse if, let's say, our editorial brand nobody was reading. But luckily, the product itself was resonating with the target audience in so many ways. So that helped a lot in terms of realizing if we have the user base that loves Skift, it's just a matter of getting money out of them, which, you know, in our various ways we do. So that is really the story of us, is essentially being able to focus, me focusing internally towards the company as opposed to being focused externally towards the investors.
You think in some ways it's going back to your roots a little bit at paid content with, you know, events, research reports, email newsletters even. I mean, it's funny how these things that have been kind of deemed as old and kind of boring are the things that just kind of work.
Going back to my roots of paid content, where I never really raised, we only raised $500,000. That's it. So I didn't really have to go out and raise money at paid content. And in Skift's case, when we did raise the initial seed, it was $2 million plus in terms of the total seed that we raised. That was a new dance for me. We raised $500,000 at paid content from one investor. That was the only conversation I had with that one investor that ended up investing. At Skift, from the start, I spoke to dozens and dozens and dozens. I may have spoken to potentially 100 plus investors over the 2 years that I did the dance. In terms of the product line, you're right. Going back to email, you know, paid content, as you very well remember, was well known as a newsletter for the longest time, even though it was a blog. For most of the rest of the industry, it was a newsletter. And that's what grew. The direct connections to our user base through email is certainly very, very familiar to us. The technologies on how to build an email list and how to retain certainly has changed to what it is now, because now it's a science.
Yeah. What is your audience? I mean, you've kind of built this over the last few years. What do you feel like they want? I mean, what is it? What do you hear from them?
You know, paid content was a little bit similar in that sense, in the sense that when these giant industries are in the throes of fears of what is happening as a result of digital and globalization, how do you turn that fear of change for these executives into a media brand that they then depend on? In Skift's case, we latched onto trends, and those trends happen to be along marketing strategy and technology. So that's what we talk about. That's what our audience and our user base and our people who come to our conferences want. Issues and challenges and in the travel industry, certainly that. We stopped chasing the tail on news, particularly.
Yeah, so you're not about breaking news as much as you are giving the real deep analysis on change within the industry.
Depending on, you know, what the subject is, but But that's not our primary focus. We, you know, we happen to come across something surely will break.
You've always, you know, been real clear and spoken your mind out online, you know, on your site, on Facebook, on Twitter. You know, you basically just kind of tell it the way it is to you. Has that ever come back to bite you?
You think?
Twitter and sometimes Facebook too.
Facebook as well, yeah. You know, I think that part of growing older, unfortunately, is that you become more confident in your own voice. And so if I was a first-time entrepreneur, I probably wouldn't have the Twitter feed that I have today. I obviously, on my Twitter and Facebook, talk not just about my journey as a media entrepreneur or my views on the larger media, but I also talk about views on race relations and larger chain, you know, larger issues in the world, terrorism, and, you know, I am a brown Muslim guy, so, you know, a lot of the cliches about what happens in the world manifest when I travel, you know, at airports and other places. So
it must suck being a Muslim and traveling now. I mean, it just feels like it's sucked for a while, but now I feel like it's just coming back and getting even worse.
Yeah, I think that. So I'll preface it by saying that I've had instances where I feel like I've been discriminated against. Interestingly enough, a lot out of London Heathrow, strangely. I just, you know, part of us hopes that the 2016 election cycle is over as soon as possible so that, you know, the theater of fear, you know, goes away. To answer your question, has that come to bite me? I'm sure it has in indirect ways. Certainly nobody's ever going to give us any money anymore. That's for sure. Even if I really wanted to. After that essay that I wrote.
Right. So like VC money is just, you know, poison. Who would want that?
If you're a sophisticated media consumer like you are, and, you know, our group is in general, you understand that Twitter and Facebook is part theater in a lot of ways. Part of it is, you know, for effect. And I hope people are able to discern some part of it. It's unlikely that they are, but I hope that they do discern that part of it is theater. You know, it's not like Fortune or Forbes or all of these media companies was beating down our door to write about Skift. It's fine. I am my own media megaphone, so I will talk about ourselves. As you probably know, I've been talking a lot about vertical media companies over the last year and a half. I do think it's having an effect in general on the larger media conversation. Sort of loose collective that I formed. We have our email discussion list, which is extremely strategic and useful to the founders that are part of that group. So I think being outspoken in the right way is when you understand what the strategic function of it is important.
What would you tell students in journalism? I know you've gone to speak at schools and stuff too, but if they come to you and say, hey, I want to start, you know, a new online media company, what would you say to them?
I will say to them, are you crazy? which is what I hope you tell them too. I have said that one, it's the best time to be a journalist in the planet ever, just because of the amount of stories that are available, accessible, the platforms that are there, your own and others to put your work out there. So there's that. I would also not buy too much into the discussion about the future of media and future of journalism in general. I think that there's too much navel-gazing, you know this well. And that if you can, stay out of some of those circles. I think that third, you and I have talked about is specialization matters in an age where everybody, you know, is supposed to know video and, you know, editing skills and video and audio and all kinds of stuff. I think that specialization in terms of a subject matter, you know, let's say you're interested in medical journalism, I'm just making that up, or environment or travel or fashion or whatever else. I think that helps, one, make you more hireable for the right type of company that is looking for that type of expertise. But also as you're building your companies, media companies, I think that trying to go out there with a general idea without any sense of what is there a focused user base for it is very difficult. I mean, it's a moonshot, and, you know, there's reason BuzzFeed and Huffington Post and Vice and Vox are exceptions. They're not the norm.
Yeah. So now here at the dawn of 2016, what are you looking forward to this year? What are you kind of worried about?
You know, from a travel perspective, I am worried about the stock market that's going up and down. And, you know, look, travel is the first sector that gets affected in any kind of stuff. So, and now that we are revenue funded, you know, that matters in terms of us bootstrapping. And so I am worried about that part. I think that everybody is excited right now about messaging, less about us as a media company, but what does it mean for travel and us being the vanguard company that helps the world of travel understand, a very exciting development like this.
So one last thing, I was checking out the first episode of the Media Twits when we were on, and you had just visited Al Jazeera, I think. And now the news is that they gave up on Al Jazeera America.
Oh yeah.
What do you think about that?
Al Jazeera America should have been Al Jazeera English, which is what everybody loved. They lost such a big chance, and the goodwill that they had back when the Arab Spring happened, they completely messed it up. They just went, the mistake that Current TV did when Current TV launched is the exact mistake that Al Jazeera did when they bought Current TV, which is just incredible. Digital, which was Al Jazeera English. I mean, AJ Plus, which you know well, is doing very well from distribution and people watching it. And they've done a great job. Those videos are fabulous. This was a chance and then they blew it. And Al Jazeera as a brand, not just Al Jazeera America, you know, I think Qatar has lost a lot of its goodwill in the world because they've supported some of the wrong players in the whole in that region. Its influence has gone down over the last few years. So that hasn't helped Al Jazeera in general.
Thanks for joining us on the show again. Good luck with Skift and your one-year-old startup.
Thank you again.
Thanks for listening to the MediaShip podcast. And thanks to our producer, Jefferson Yen, and our guest, Rafat Ali. Check out the latest news and features at mediashift.org and follow us at MediaShipPod on Twitter. Our past episodes are on SoundCloud and YouTube. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes and leave us a review. We'll catch you next week.